Each time I see you, I break down and cry.
Welcome, everybody. This is Mark Steiner, and we are another one of our programs we're doing today on the Annapolis Summit, on a lead up to the Annapolis Summit, with our partner, the Daily Record. They write stories in their issues leading up to the Annapolis Summit every Monday. This one is by Steve Lash on pretrial issues on lawyers, lawmakers' docket. And we are having the same conversation on this program now that we have had for years on the issue of pretrial issues and the law. We are joined by two men who have been on this program again many, many times talking about this. In studio is Doug Colbert, professor of law at the University of Maryland Carey School of Law, and Paul DeWolf, Maryland's public defender. And Doug and Paul, welcome. Good to have you with us.
Thank you, Mark.
Thank you. Great to be here.
So over the years, we've had so many programs of the last 23 years around pretrial issues and the right to a lawyer at your first hearing after being arrested and taken into custody. That you legally have in the first your bail hearing that you're supposed to legally have within 24 hours after you are arrested. The argument has always been whether or not there should be a lawyer at that bail hearing, and it was decided by Maryland's highest court, yes. But then the political motions began. After that began, so Doug, let me get you both perspectives a little bit of history here, Doug.
Well, let me just give 60 seconds of history here, Mark, because what your listeners must appreciate is that it's always been an uphill climb to guarantee equal justice to poor people. And it begins when poor people are denied a lawyer when they are in the position of being accused of a crime. You know, we have a Sixth Amendment to the United States Constitution, and it says that in all criminal prosecutions, an accused shall have the right to the assistance of a lawyer. Now, it seems pretty clear, but it took over 170 years before the right to a lawyer meant that a poor person could be guaranteed counsel at a felony trial. And it took another 10 years, 180 years, before the guarantee of a lawyer applied to misdemeanor trials, which is what most people are charged with. So we have this situation where states have been unwilling to guarantee people a lawyer except a trial. But trial's a myth. Very few people actually go to trial. You might have 5%, maybe as many as 10%. Most people either have their charges dismissed or they plead guilty. So what we're looking at here is where it's most important. And the most important place to have a lawyer, Mark, for you, for me, for everyone who's listening, is when you first appear before a judicial officer. Why? Because your freedom's at stake there, and a lawyer makes a huge difference at the beginning. And yet the opposition to guaranteeing people, poor people, a lawyer, and disproportionately it's African-American Latinos, people who are going to fall in the economically disadvantaged, working people who cannot afford a private lawyer. So that's been the struggle. The struggle over the last 7 years in the Richmond litigation that we've been an important part of has been to extend the right to counsel to the very beginning of a criminal trial. But the opposition has been fierce.
And Paul, I mean, during this whole time, and we talked before the decision was made and since the decision was made and the politics of it, I mean, talk a bit about why there's, from your perspective, why there's been so much consternation around this issue before the court decided.
Well, I think there are two major issues. One is the issue that Doug Colbert very eloquently described, and that's the right to counsel at the initial appearance. When that critical decision is being made whether someone is to lose their freedom or go home pending trial on the promise that they'll show up for trial and won't commit another crime. The second issue, though, is the issue of pretrial detention and the pretrial detention rates. And what we've seen in Maryland is that we detain people at higher than the national average. And these are people that haven't been convicted of a crime, but only have been accused of a crime. So while it's important to make sure that when a person is represented at the initial appearance, it's also important that the system itself takes a look at pretrial incarceration rates because it really does play into the whole concept of over-incarceration in America. Now, to answer your question, the reason that it has been so controversial heretofore, I think primarily has to do with costs to the system.
Right.
The cost to pay for counsel at that initial appearance, who's going to provide that counsel and who's going to pay for it. But attendant with those costs of the right to counsel, there are costs to the states, to the state's attorney's office, to the counties, to the correctional facilities, and that's where the political football, the political wrangling has come about, if you will, because whenever you implement reform, there's attendant cost to it, and whenever you implicate the budget, which can be seen as a pie chart, any sliver of that budget is going to be fought over by everyone who has a stake in the process. So for the past four legislative sessions, the Public Defender's Office and the plaintiffs in the Richmond litigation, of which Doug is an important part, have been in the middle of a maelstrom of give and take over the overall cost of this decision and the implementation, which entity is going to implement the right to counsel. But I think we shouldn't really lose sight of the fact that the most important issue is the fact that we detain people prior to their being found guilty at high rates, specifically in places like Baltimore City, in Prince George's County, and other larger counties where, as Doug says, they're mostly populated by minorities. The Richmond Task Force and the Governor's Commission has been taking a look at reform to the pretrial justice system.
So I think that at this point, I mean, from everything I've read and things leading up to this and talking to people in Annapolis, Doug, I mean, the monetary issue does seem to be underlying this, and we'll get to the battle of who actually does this work in a moment. But it does come with a cost.
It comes with enormous savings, Mark. And the savings come from the fact that when people who are charged with driving without a license or disorderly conduct or possession of marijuana or these minor nonviolent offenses, when they remain in jail at a cost of $100 to $150 a day, we, the taxpayers, pay for that. When you have a lawyer present, our data shows that a lawyer makes an enormous difference, particularly for nonviolent offenses, which is what 92% of the people are arrested for. You see, what's missing here, and when we talk about political wrangling, first of all, the statistics about the people who are found guilty in our state are abysmally low. Low. You have between 35 and 40% of people arrested who are found guilty, which means 60 to 65%. Of people who are arrested either get their cases dismissed or placed on the inactive docket for a stet. So what's happening in the meantime is that poor people, low-income people, are remaining in jail because they can't afford bail. We've had bails as low as $50. We've had $250, $500. And the thing that we're not talking about yet is who's the opposition here? Because, you see, there's been a system in place for so long in which the bail bondsmen have been the ones who have been conducting the business of deciding who gets released and who stays in jail. And they are a very powerful lobby in Annapolis. No one really wants to talk about it because there's a lot of baggage that goes along with it.
Well, I'm going to parse some stuff out because of what you just said just now. I'm going to come back to what you just said. I mean, about who's benefiting from this and also looking at who was at the hearings last year and who were not at the hearings last year when this took place. The question of money that you raised, Paul, and Doug, this is a real question. The difference is that we do not have for whatever reason it seems, and you guys can agree or disagree with this, we do not have a legislative system that looks at what you're talking about. You can't mixing apples and oranges, people say. The cost of keeping somebody incarcerated is not the same pot of money as the cost of what it will cost to pay lawyers to do the work of keeping people out of prison, or at least representing them at their bail hearing. And it's hard to make those things cross.
Mark, we're talking about a constitutional right. There is no cost to a constitutional right.
Well, there always is a cost of a constitutional right.
There's a cost of not following and protecting people's constitutional rights. And we saw that in Brown v. Board of Education, where for years there was resistance against a court order.
What I'm saying is that we live in a capitalist system. So whenever you make changes in this capitalist system, there are going to be actual financial costs connected to whatever it is we do, right?
Well, that is true, and we did see in the last four legislative sessions the fact that there were powerful forces at bay that were trying to prevent the payment of money to attorneys to represent poor people at initial appearances. When you think about it, in the scheme of things, the legislators represent their own individual districts, and the individual budgets, the state budget, have to be divided among things like school costs and health programs. And there has been a huge resistance to pay for the payment of attorneys for indigent criminal defendants. That's not a Maryland problem. That's a national problem. Funding for indigent defense is a crisis across the country. But I think Doug makes a good point, and that is that when we're talking about not just money for lawyers and not just funding of a public defense system. We're talking about the criminal justice system that depends upon every branch. I liken it to the three-legged stool. You have to have a very strong judiciary, which we do. You have to have a very strong prosecution function, which we typically do in every jurisdiction in Maryland. But the third part of it is you have to have a very strong defense system that defends people's right from overreaching by the judiciary, overreaching by the executive branch. And historically, the defense function has been strong across the country, but where it has fallen down has been for funding for lawyers for poor people when they're faced with the power of the judiciary, the power of the criminal justice system. And in those places where the defense function has been robust and fully funded, that's where we see models of justice, models of a system that's working for everybody's rights, including those people that are poor and underprivileged.
But it seems to me, Doug, that, I mean, if you have something else to say in interjecting before you answer this question, but it seems to me that when I look at this thing politically, that you've got the chairman of the House committee, Valerio, and the incoming chairman of the Senate committee, Zirkin, neither one who seemed very excited about passing either the money for the public defender's office or for the complexities of having this independent judiciary supplying lawyers to go in and defend indigents, and this new system that many people for and against this seem to be opposed to, which is this new computerized system to determine whether you or I should be able to get bail.
Mark, there have always been vested interests who have been against poor people having a lawyer, low-income people having a lawyer. There's also been a lot of opposition to changing a system so that money doesn't decide freedom. Money should not decide freedom. It's irrational to let the rich person out of jail who's going to get out of jail and do harm to someone, and it's irrational to keep the poor person in jail because they don't have $100. That doesn't make sense. We're free, and what's important here, Mark, and what hasn't been talked about yet, is that Governor O'Malley created a commission to study the pretrial justice system. And on the commission, there was a wide variety of people, including considerable bail bondsman representation on the committee. I wasn't on the committee, but I attended the meetings. And they are about to make recommendations
right.
that call for the elimination of money bail because in a decisive vote, the commission decided it doesn't make sense. Like, we're not holding the right people in jail. We're not letting the right people out of jail so they can go back to family, back to job. So the commission calls elimination of money bail, elimination of the bail bondsman to be replaced by more pretrial supervision based upon an objective standard, not a judge or a commissioner picking a number out of the air and saying your bail's $10,000. No, and that does happen. It doesn't happen with every judicial officer, but it happens frequently. When you have an objective risk assessment, which is not obligatory, it's not mandatory, it's a recommendation based upon a person's background. And it has worked in states, it has worked in cities, and what it does is it takes the bail bondsman and money out of the picture, and it replaces it with something that says, we don't want to be spending our tax dollars on keeping low-level offenders in jail, and there are many in jail today throughout the state.
But these recommendations haven't been published yet.
No, they haven't been, but they have been voted on. Paul's a member of the committee, and he can certainly speak to it.
So if those, in fact, are happening, Paul, that's going to receive a lot of opposition from some of the people who run these committees and are on these committees.
Well, I think there is going to be opposition. There's always opposition when there's vested interest to keep the status quo as it is. But I do think that the commission represents a broad stretch of the criminal justice system, and the recommendations that they're about to make are not radical at all. They've been tested throughout places and throughout the United States, and have shown to be effective in controlling the pretrial population. Here's what I think reform looks like, and I think this is where the commission, the governor's commission, is going. The first point is to move towards a system where you use evidence-based practices to inform the decision maker, whether it be a judge or commissioner, about the risk of release. And when we talk about risk, we talk about whether someone is going to show up to the court, the risk of flight, or whether someone is going to reoffend while they're out on bail, and that's the risk of committing another crime. And there are evidence-based tools that have been tested and validated that are highly predictive. It's highly predictive of those two factors, whether someone's going to show up or not, and whether someone's going to commit another crime. And so I heard you even reference to it, Mark, the fact that they use a computer system.
Right.
It's not, that's how it's been criticized. But what it is, in fact, is a tool that has been tested, validated with scientific method to determine whether it is predictive of these two factors. And in the places that it has been used, it's been validated using tens of thousands of actual cases, and therefore, it moves us to a system of evidence-based decision making, and that can only be progress. And the second thing that the commission is about to recommend, which I think also is a movement that could only be considered an advancement or reform, is that we're going to ask the legislature to lessen or to take a strong look at the dependence on money bail to implement the release or detention of an individual. Now, it's not only poor people that can't afford $100 or $500 that stay in jail, whereas someone that has resources and money gets out. That's one inequality. But what these tools are able to show is those people that are going to that are high risk to reoffend, and money does nothing to keep high risk people in jail. All it really does is separate those high risk people that have money from those that don't. No matter how serious your crime is, if you've got a lot of resources, and think about drug kingpins or think about mafia figures, they walk out of prison and jail the same day that they're arrested because those resources are forthcoming, and that shows the inequality of the system, whereas someone who has committed a very minor offense stays in jail. So what the evidence-based practice moves us towards is to use these tools to inform the judge. These aren't to be used. I don't think anyone nowadays supports automatic release. But what these tools will do is will inform judges and commissioners and decision makers. It will inform their decision about whether someone should be released or whether someone should be detained based upon not money, or based upon not an interview or hunches, but based upon actual evidence-based standards.
So one of the things that you know, I was just before I we went here on air together, I was reading some old articles, and one of the articles I looked at was from March the 18th, 1999. And then still Chairman Valerio of the House Judiciary Committee and the bail bondsman were, and this, for opening, the opening of the story was, a powerful House Committee chairman of Maryland's and Maryland's bail bond industry had been waging a behind-the-scenes campaign to kill a bill seeking to ease Baltimore's clogged criminal justice system. And this was written back in 1999. So we've been covering this for a long time. So the question is, I mean, there seem to be, both in terms of both chair and some of the Defense Lawyers Associations and bail bondsmen really oppose this on all fronts. And I mean, that seems to be the political battle that you all, no matter how you think this should end up, are up against. And the question is posed, so why are they always opposed to this?
Well, Mark, first of all, March 18th, 1999 happens to be an anniversary date of the Supreme Court ruling in 1963 that said, finally, poor people are guaranteed a lawyer at a felony trial. So it's a significant date. But having a lawyer threatens vested interests. It's the reason bail bondsmen oppose it is that they have a vested interest in people staying in jail. You see, when people stay in jail, Mark, they want to get out. It's not a pleasant experience. And they'll pay to get out. And they'll pay even if they're the working person who brings home $300 a week, and that money's supposed to go for rent and food and utilities, but they've got to get out of jail because they're supporting a family. So the only way that most people can get out of jail in our state, the way it's been used over and over again, is to pay the bondsman the 10% non-refundable fee. They get a penny on a they get 10 cents on the dollar, but bail's not set at a dollar. Bail's set much higher. So they'll get $1,000 on a $10,000 bond and $10,000 on a $100,000 bond. And when we did the study in 2002, we estimated their revenue at $150 million a year back then. So we're talking about a business decision. The reason bondsmen didn't want lawyers there is that lawyers give a person a better chance of getting out. The reason they don't want risk assessment is that it's going to replace what's taking place now, which is a very random, haphazard system with no objective standards, for one that's going to at least provide a very good guideline. And most of the judicial officers, I have to say, Mark, would appreciate more information. It's not taking their decision-making away. It's just helping them get to the right place.
We only have literally have a few minutes left in our segment. And so very quickly from both of you, and I'll start, and I mean very quickly, but let's go to Paul and then Doug. I mean, the way this is panning out, it seems that, the part of the battle is going to be, we don't know where this is going to end up, but there's going to be a huge fight on both these judiciary committees. There's no question about that, no matter what the commission comes out with. One of those fights for you, Paul, has to do with whether or not if lawyers are, if we finally get to the point where poor people are allowed to have lawyers at their initial bail hearing, whether or not it's going to be this, how it's going to be funded, will it be funded to the PD's office or someplace else?
Well, the commission is about to recommend that, let me read this to you, the commission should recommend that under no circumstances should we institutionalize the judicial branch of government as the line manager of what amounts to the lawyer referral service program for attorneys to represent indigent criminally accused in their first appearance before a commissioner. The Office of the Public Defender was created by statute to represent indigent criminally accused. It is an executive branch government of the state government and should have that responsibility. So the commission will recommend that the public defender take over the assigned attorney program, and the judiciary supports that.
Yeah, and from my point of view, Mark, there's no question that the public defender should be receiving the resources to provide representation and continuous representation. Right now, people are getting a lawyer that they won't see except for the one time that they see that person at the initial appearance. That's not effective lawyering. You need the same lawyer to be continuing, and Paul's office provides the training, and they ought to be funded. It would save the taxpayer money. But I have to point out that, you know, we've always been such a decided underdog here. It's almost like the Orioles trying to escape, you know, the basement or fourth place, and the opposition is so much stronger. And that's what it's like in Annapolis. When you go to Annapolis, we have so little resources. The only thing that's ever going to overcome the political strength of the bondsmen and the legislators who support the bondsmen will be a public outcry. It's going to take community and people to say that money should never decide freedom. We've been through a system earlier in our history where you could buy your way out of slavery, out of incarceration, if you had $300 to emancipate yourself. For me, the current money system has a lot of resemblance to the old system that was abolished a long time ago.
And let me just say that we did ask Chairman Villario and Zirkin to join us for this conversation, and we'll be looking forward to talking to them in the future. But for this particular episode, Delegate Villario was in court all day, and Senator Zirkin was busy all day in meetings, so they could not join us here today, which is why they're not in the room or in part of this conversation. Just want to let you all know that. But I do want to thank our guests, Paul DeWolf, Maryland Public Defender. Looking forward to seeing you very soon. Thank you so much for joining us, Paul.
Thank you very much, Mark.
And Doug Colbert, Professor of Law at the Maryland School of Law. Good to have you with us as well.
Thank you very much, Mark.
And this has been part of our series running up to the Annapolis Summit in January. Thank you all very much for joining us. You can read the articles by the Daily Record at their site, which we'll be linking to on our site, steinershow.org. On our way to break, we're hearing Tighten Up Zydeco by the great Clifton Chenier and the Louisiana Ramblers. Clifton Chenier, Grammy Award-winning artist and the king of Zydeco, died on this day in 1984.